This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Dave Wilson. Today on Dialogue, some staggering numbers about child poverty in our province. The Canadian Cancer Society wants you to go dry in February, and the life of a lighthouse keeper on St. Paul's Island. That's all coming up on Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. A new study shows that nearly 35% of children in Cape Breton are living in poverty. The provincial rate is 24.2%, or close to one in four children. Acadia University professor and study co-author Dr. Leslie Frank says those staggering numbers paint a grim picture of families facing challenges such as deciding whether to buy groceries or heat their homes. She spoke with Dialogue's Bill McCush.
Well, looking at the Nova Scotia statistics for child poverty, what we see in relation to the other provinces is that we have the third highest rate of child poverty in Canada, and we have the highest rate of child poverty in Atlantic Canada. And that's been a consistent ranking of our placement, I guess you could say, nationally for some time now. So that hasn't moved in some number of years.
In the study, you say this year's report card marks the 30th anniversary of the promise to end child poverty. And for you, this is 20 years of marking data. Are you pleased with what you've seen over the past couple of decades?
No, I'm not pleased. What we've seen, if you track child poverty statistics over time, is that after the promise to end child poverty, by the year 2000, the child poverty rates actually across the country rose significantly. At the year 2000, they were in fact much higher than they were when the promise was made. And child poverty rates have declined since 2000, but the decline hasn't been steady. So it has declined and increased and declined, usually in line with some, if we look just at Nova Scotia in particular, with certain measures that get put in place either federally or provincially. But there's been no sort of steady decline over time. It's been fluctuating. And so that what that says to me is sort of a sort of lack of commitment to set a target and put in measures that can actually get us to that target in a consistent way. And the what we also have seen of very recent years in Nova Scotia is troubling, because in relation to the rest of Canada, we have actually performed quite poorly in our child poverty reduction. So, for example, in 2016, there was quite an enhancement in the Canada Child Benefit put in place by the federal government, which did lower child poverty rates as a result across the country. When you look at data for Nova Scotia, however, no matter what data source you look at, whether it be tax filer data, which is primarily the data that's used in this report, or if we look at survey data like the Canadian Income Survey, Nova Scotia has relatively performed poorly. So there has been a slight reduction in child poverty based on tax filer data. But if we look at Canadian Income Survey data, Nova Scotia is the only province where the child poverty rate actually increased during that time frame, when we would have expected a significant decrease in child poverty because of the federal investment. And it decreased in every other province.
You mentioned the federal investment of 2016. If this report card reflecting data from 2017, and here we are in 2020, do you think anything has changed significantly over the past few years when it comes to the most recent report card?
Well, so the most recent report card actually reflects data from our first full year of federal investment in the Canada Child Benefit, and then also like the half year that of 2016. And so that's when we would have expected a decrease. And like I said, depending on the data source you look at, there's either a slight decrease or actually an increase. And in CENSO, 2017 is the last available, of course, income statistic data we have. We always have a two-year lag in statistics when it comes to income data, and that's typical of any kind of data about Canadians. Often what gets said by some is that, oh, these statistics are 2 years old and are not reflective of our current state of affairs. Now, the benefit of being somebody that has tracked child poverty statistics for 20 years is that I know that little changes over those 2 years and hasn't historically. And so if you have the same sort of policy measures in place, 2 years' time from now, nothing will be different. And that has proven to be true in the 20 years that I've been tracking this. So, for example, we do have data from 2018 about welfare incomes in Nova Scotia. And that is in the report card. And what that shows, if we look at the total welfare incomes in Nova Scotia, which includes that federal investment in the child tax benefit, but also looks at our income assistance rates in the province and any provincial government tax transfers to families, that our welfare incomes actually decreased from 2017 to 2018, partly because some of those measures, particularly in the provincial government, are not indexed to inflation. So I don't expect things to be any better based on 2018 data either, looking forward. So we'll wait and see, but we can't wait and see forever for 30 years because we're talking about children. These are children's lives where 2 years makes a difference in their development and health outcomes.
If we can focus on Cape Breton just for a moment, the report card showing Cape Breton's rate of 34.9%, but Escazonia has more children living in poverty than anyone else in Cape Breton, a staggering 73.2%, roughly three times the provincial rate. At what point should we consider those numbers to be a crisis?
Well, in many regards, if we have poverty statistics that are, you know, in one in three, but it's particularly anything, you know, over 50%. I mean, these are staggering numbers when we compare them, particularly across the country. For example, the Sydney, Victoria electoral district has a child poverty rate of 36.6%. Partly, you know, people say, well, what's that about? Well, nobody really, like, does a lot of digging to find out, to see, you know, what this is about. But we can look to things like the census to have a look at, okay, well, what does this riding look like? You know, who lives in this riding? And there are things we can glean from the census. So, for example, it's not just that it has the sort of highest percentage of children of Aboriginal identity in the province. It in fact does. But it also has the highest unemployment rates in the province, and it also has the highest percentage of lone parent families in the province. And, you know, we know that the child poverty rates are higher for children of Aboriginal identity and visible minority identity and for new immigrant children. And we also know that the child poverty rate is higher in lone parent families. And most of our, you know, over 80% of our lone parent families are female-led. So there's, you know, a gender component to this as well. So, you know, these are staggering rates. And then there's lots to say, okay, well, you know, it's not just you know, who's responsible to fix these things? You know, a lot of these things have to do with historical inequalities of colonial relations, of racism, of gender inequality. So the issues are quite complex. And, you know, and there's both the federal government and the provincial government has a role to play in these, in solving these problems. And in particular for First Nations, and I don't want to speak on the behalf of First Nations at all, but I believe that there's a feeling that perhaps the poverty statistics themselves need work. They might not, in fact, reflect some of the realities that or measure in the way that they would like, you know, well-being to be measured in their communities. And so there's been some work on, you know, are these the best indicators for perhaps the social problems that may be experienced for children? And they may or may not be. I'm not going to speak on that. But, you know, clearly these are problems that are rooted in long histories that need solutions that need to come about through self-government initiatives that are supported by the federal government.
So the province doesn't have an official poverty reduction strategy. Do you think people should do more to encourage government to better address this issue?
Absolutely. You know, the federal government has, you know, created the first ever federal poverty reduction strategy. I would argue that it doesn't go far enough and the timelines are too long, especially, I mean, we're talking about children's lives, long timelines translate into, you know, more problems for children. However, that being said, I mean, it's good news that there is a federal poverty reduction strategy. They have made some decisions on poverty measurement, and they have made some, you know, benchmarks of success. You know, I would say they need to be better. But the province doesn't have a poverty reduction strategy that, you know, even picks a threshold of poverty, sets timelines for poverty reduction. It, you know, and there's some things, of course, it has in place to try to reduce poverty or at least support families living in poverty. But supporting families living in poverty is different than lowering poverty. It's different than addressing income inequality. You know, so putting our energies into sort of alleviating the poor outcomes that are attached to poverty is a reactive approach rather than a preventative approach. And the things that are in place that could do some work, like actual government transfers to families, are not doing what they could be doing because they're not strong enough. And so just some small things in Nova Scotia, like having income assistance rates that are enough to, you know, be able to buy your groceries or pay for your housing, and having those rates actually be reflective on the rising cost of these things is very important. And the income assistance rates are put families thousands of dollars below the poverty line on an annual basis. So, and then also the other government transfers like the Nova Scotia Child Benefit, it's not indexed to inflation. So it is a mechanism that could reduce poverty if it was kept pace. But every year that goes by that it's not indexed to inflation, it just has less and less power to reduce poverty in any way.
Are those part of the issues that lead to families making unfortunate decisions, such as deciding whether or not to heat their homes or buy food for their family?
Well, I would say food and heat in your house and paying for your housing are the biggest challenges for families. you know, the child benefit that comes to families often gets eaten up by housing costs. Particularly if you're on income assistance, you don't receive money to feed your kids on income assistance. Money only goes to the adults in the household. There's no food dollars attached to that. You know, you're supposed to pay for your children's food, I guess, if you're on income assistance with your child benefit. But the child benefit, a lot of it goes to the overages on what the housing is costing people. And therefore, there isn't the money to buy groceries for children. And more and more and more families relying on food charity, which in itself is a problem and doesn't meet people's needs. So, you know, addressing these problems through charity routes is not a pathway to social justice for these families. It's what we put in place when all these other things fail. But of course, there's other things that happen with children and families. Is, you know, they can't participate in society in the way that other children can. They don't. They have difficult time having school supplies. Having not just taking food to school, but participating in school activities. In rural Nova Scotia, it means transportation insecurity, not being able to get places, having cars that are, you know, barely on the road. It leads to daily struggles in the lives of families, trying to just get through the day, whether that be buying medications, buying diapers, you know, putting gas in your car. You know, one thing that I know happens a fair amount in Cape Breton that is that families can't afford to fill their oil tanks. They can't afford the minimum delivery for oil, and they have to get diesel fuel from the gas station in cans to put that in their oil tanks. And so, you know, these are things that you're juggling on a daily basis.
Must be very difficult for people to imagine there are some children out there who can't concentrate on their schoolwork when they're hungry and they're cold. In your experience, do you see a lot of kids who are able to bounce back as they get older, and are they able to reverse those trends?
That's an interesting question. You know, the child poverty rates are the highest for youngest children, right? So children 0 to 2. These are when children are at their most vulnerable developmentally. Then, of course, they move into the school system. Yes, and as you say, you know, there's you know, poor educational outcomes for children that are living in low-income circumstances. And these outcomes carry through educationally. Like, there's lower rates of educational attainment all along the life course of a child. There's less kids coming from poor homes that are in university here where I am teaching. You know, first generation university students have different kind of struggles than children coming from families that have been, you know, their generations of going to university. But we also see, I mean, I see even in kids that have transferred into university environments, they're still struggling. I mean, I also do research on student food insecurity at the post-secondary level, and we have very high rates of student food insecurity here in Nova Scotia, where we have its rates that are much higher than other populations. I did a study here a few years ago at Acadia, and the rate of student food insecurity was 38%. So these things carry forward throughout the life course. I'm sure individual children overcome these things. Of course they do. But what I'm talking about is a social problem that is structural in nature. And of course, individual people can overcome things, but that doesn't change the social problem.
Aside from encouraging government officials to move forward with the official poverty reduction strategy, is it naive to think that even a small gesture can help those families, such as donating at your local food bank?
Well, one thing I have noticed over the longevity of doing this report card is more and more, I would say, different groups in the province have become concerned and are advocating for something to change in child poverty and family poverty. So I would say more and more there's this sense of community outrage, particularly in some groups, like in teachers that have to address this problem daily in their classrooms. So I have a sense that there's a collective feeling in Nova Scotia that something needs to change. And people often ask me, you know, what is it that I can do as an individual? And for one thing, what we tended to do is to think of charity gestures that we can do, like giving food to a food bank, participating in fundraising. And that is, I'm not going to say that is a bad thing to do. I personally do that when I'm asked to do that. But I want to be really clear about something when it comes to these being the only things we do. Charity is never a substitute for social justice and changing inequality dynamics. It can only alleviate the pain. It can't prevent the social problem. So it's very difficult not to feed somebody when they show up at your door hungry. And of course, and I will do that along with everybody else. But if we only do that, we are missing the point that, you know, we also need to, you know, as an individual, one thing is fight the stereotypes that poverty is because of a personal deficit, something that you've done to cause it, that it's actually rooted in it, dynamics of social inequality. We need to spread that message amongst our community. We need to also advocate for change at the government level, at the state level, which allows inequality to get worse over time in Canada and in Nova Scotia. You know, we have to advocate for just social policy that embraces a social safety net that can actually leave people some dignity and the capacity to feed themselves.
The Canadian Cancer Society is hoping a fundraising campaign this month will catch on and at the same time make people aware of the risk of increased alcohol consumption. Dialogue spoke with Kelly Cull, Regional Director of Public Policy for the Cancer Society, about Dry February. Kelly, tell me, first of all, where did the idea for National Dry February come from?
Well, there's a couple of other organizations in the world, internationally, the UK and Australia, that started this campaign around Dry February. And the idea being that we're encouraging Canadians to go alcohol-free in February to raise funds for the Canadian Cancer Society. And so this has been a big movement in other parts of the country. And last year, we brought it over formally into Canada at the Canadian Cancer Society. And we're relaunching again. We saw a lot of success last year, and we want to see even more success with it this year.
I don't think a lot of people would be aware of the fact that increased alcohol consumption also increased the risks of a lot of cancers.
You're absolutely right. There was actually an interesting survey that was done a little while back that actually told us that only about a third of Canadians knew that there was a direct correlation between alcohol use as well as cancer risk. But the truth is that drinking any type of alcohol will increase your risk of a number of different types of cancers, including head and neck, breast, stomach, pancreatic, colorectal cancer. So there is a direct link. The bottom line here is that less is more when it comes to alcohol, and the less you drink, the more you reduce your risk.
Now, how do you go about actually raising the money? Because that's the purpose of this, is it not?
That is, yeah. So you can sort of join this campaign through our website at dryfeb.ca. You go on there, you make a profile, you can share you can share what you're doing with your friends, and that's the platform where you can set up your own profile as well as raise money from friends and family.
Without putting much effort into it in the past, you did manage to raise a considerable amount of money.
Last year, the organization raised $600,000, and so this year we're looking to get close to $1 million. And that money really goes to support the work of the Canadian Cancer Society. We have three core mandates. The first is that we fund cancer research across all different types of cancers. We also have a huge network of support system for people who are living with cancer and their caregivers, including programs here in Nova Scotia like the Lodge That Gives, which is a home away from home for people who are required to travel to Halifax for cancer treatment. And we also advocate governments for healthy public policy.
As a regional director for public policy for the Canadian Cancer Society, the situation in Nova Scotia as it stands right now, in particular, here you're talking to a station in Cape Breton, we have a cancer rate that's twice the national average. It's a challenging time.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and public policy is an important part of our mandate because we know that public policies can, shift culture, can change some of our health behaviors, but we also want to make sure that governments are supporting cancer patients in a way that's meaningful and impactful on their lives. So, examples of the work that we do in the public policy realm are we advocate for better tobacco control measures. Right now we're really focused on curbing the amount of young people who are vaping. Another example would be our advocacy to the federal government. We're asking the federal government to improve support for cancer patients through the EI sickness benefit. We want to see that benefit increase from 15 to 26 weeks. So people who are living with cancer or going through cancer diagnosis can be supported financially, while they're in that journey.
Back to a dry February, how difficult do you think it's going to be to convince some people?
Well, you know what? That's kind of part of the fun thing about this is that Canadians really are interested in taking up this challenge. It's a good test and a good opportunity. If you've set New Year's resolutions, for example, you want to run a 5K or a 10K, go dry this February and then work towards, a different kind of goal in your life. So we know that Canadians are really interested, and we know that it's positively impacting Canadians' lives. We surveyed people who participated in Dry February last year, and a lot of them told us that through this challenge, they would reduce their consumption of alcohol, even going forward into the rest of the year. And so we know that this is a nice pause for thought. It helps people reassess their health behaviors and helps them make a bit of a change.
I imagine that you'd find the occasional person, too, that would say, well, perhaps I don't need alcohol in my life.
I think that it is kind of a reevaluation. It's kind of a pause for thought and a chance to sort of really look at your alcohol consumption and your behaviors and decide if you want to do things differently.
So once again, how does if someone is interested and they say, yeah, I'd like to give this a try, how do they go about it and how do they donate?
So you can help us make a difference. You can go dry this February, feel all the benefits, and you can register or donate today at dryfeb.ca.
It's known as the Graveyard of the Gulf, over 200 shipwrecks and the final resting place for countless sailors. Billy Budge was just 7 years old when his father took a job as the lighthouse keeper on St. Paul's Island back in 1955. His family packed up and moved from Neal's Harbor to the desolate island, 25 kilometers northeast of Cape North. Although it was a once-in-a-lifetime adventure, the family had to give up things like going to school, shopping, and electricity. Dialogue spoke with Budge about his life experiences on the island.
Can you describe the scenery of the island? We're told it's under heavy fog during the navigation season, rock-faced cliffs, rugged shores, crashing waves.
Beaches are not beaches as you think. They're not sand beaches. They're rocky pebble beaches at the smallest, but mostly they were boulder beaches, but we call them beaches anyway. And look for things that might have drifted ashore after a storm. And most of the island is surrounded by vertical cliffs, or goes beyond vertical. They overhang a bit, and they're about 60 feet high and higher in some places. And the island is situated on the northeast, southwest, trajectory. And for fishing boats, for southwest wind, there is a little bit of shelter. For northeast wind, there's absolutely no shelter whatsoever there. So boats get caught at that time, have to get out of there or find a safer place to spend the storm.
The island is nicknamed the Graveyard of the Gulf. Why do you think the island acquired this nickname?
Because there were so many shipwrecks in the days before lighthouses or any other marine navigational aids that were installed there.
About how many shipwrecks would you say?
According to Elliot Storm, who told me a number of years ago that there could be as many as a couple of hundred out there. In some cases, they would find one shipwreck on top of another. And we heard a close call one night when a ship came very close to the island and almost ran ashore, and you could hear the people screaming on board, the sailors. They must have caught our lighthouse at the last minute, and the boats gradually began to pull away from the island, but we knew that was one close call for sure.
What was it like growing up on St. Paul Island?
It was a way of life that was very different than most kids, because there were nobody else out there on the end of the island that we were on. We were all alone, the four of us in the family. And at one time, for the first almost a whole year, there was a radio operator stationed at Atlantic Cove, which is about a mile and a half away along a very narrow winding path that we used to take the term farm tractor to navigate between the two. But in 1956, in August, that station was closed, and we were left alone for the next 4.5 years. And there's another island off the northeast end of St. Paul's Island named the Northeast. And there were the lake keeper and his wife and a couple of children, as well as assistant lighthouse keepers, because he had a radio beacon and a foghorn and a few other things to operate there. But we never got to see them much because they're on the far end of the island, and in the wintertime that was unnavigable. No way to get there. So we were basically alone on the southwest end. And schoolwork was done by correspondence. And you complete so many lessons and send them, supposed to be sent into Halifax to be corrected by examiners. But that was a problem, because after November, or sometimes there'd be a supply ship that would drop off supplies in December, but not always. And our lessons would be sent in to that point. But after December, no boats came, and so there's no way to get lessons in to Halifax to have them corrected. And so the next boat would come around in May, and we'd ship all the lessons into Halifax that were done over the winter, which was kind of annoyed the examiners in Halifax, because they wanted them weekly, and no way to get them in by the week. And of course, if you made a mistake during, say, January, you wouldn't know about it till the summer of next year that you actually could correct something. So it was quite different for sure, but we seemed to get along, and we all passed. And we had a routine, and we worked on Saturday, too, because in order to keep our food supply up, we used to hunt ducks and provide us with fresh meat that we never had a room to hold enough for the winter I'm talking about roast beef and stuff like that. Only the freezer only held so much, and so we'd shoot ducks for supply enough food. And we'd hunt ducks every morning and do schoolwork all afternoon and all evening. That was usually the schedule.
How often would the supply ships visit St. Paul Island?
Most of the food and supplies for the lighthouse were delivered in September. That would be oil and gasoline to operate the station, as well as basically food for the whole winter. So there'd be cans of milk and everything that was usually in cans that you could preserve it. But there's a certain amount of meat that we've cut up and put in the actually it was a refrigerator that froze from top to bottom, a kerosene operated refrigerator, by the way, and that would keep us going in meat that we could afford, or we could actually able to freeze. So, everything was basically delivered in September, food and supplies for the lighthouse. And after in the summer came, there'd be fishing boats that bring out fresh supplies every time they would come to the island to set their traps or set trawl gear. We knew they were coming, and we'd get them to bring a few things from the store for fresh food. So that would be helped until the fall when the fishing boats never come back to the island anymore.
For your father, who is maintaining the lighthouse, it's not exactly like flicking a switch on. There was an awful lot of work involved in that.
Yeah, there was a lot of work in maintaining the station itself. That's painting and looking after other parts of the station, the water supply. And the lighthouse, actually, to light the light, took better part of an hour, actually, to pump air in the tanks, put gas in the tanks, and hoist up the weights, which was operated by a winch, weight sliding down the cable over the cliff that kept the lighthouse rotating. And the rotation of the light actually was a Fresnel lens assembly, which rotated in a vat of mercury. And by the rotating of the light, the lenses went past in front of the fixed lantern, and it would cause an illusion that would be a flash. But it wasn't really a flash at all. It was the lenses rotating in front of the light that made the flash sequence. When the flash sequence was also a code that passing ships knew that there were two quick flashes and a certain amount of period between the next one, they could look at their chart and say, well, that's the code for St. Paul's Southwest Light, so that's where we're passing. So it was important to keep the timing on right on, too, as well. And so I recall, once in an ice storm, we had to keep the light rotating, and the carriage that carries the weights down over the cliff on a cable, it puts kinetic pressure, I guess you put, you say, on the mechanism that causes the light to turn. It's like a winch working in reverse, and ice would accumulate on the cable and stop from traveling down the cliff, and the light would stop. So Dad had to put a ladder up against the icy lighthouse and stand on that ladder and pound on the cable to beat the ice accretion up so the thing could keep traveling. So that was a pretty hairy experience on the edge of a cliff, too.
Did you like helping your dad operate the lighthouse?
The thing that I did every night was crank those weights up every night in the wintertime, they'd travel all the way to the bottom of the cliff, and they had to crank them all the way up with a winch inside underneath the lighthouse lighting mechanism. And we crank them up, and you pull a pin when you get them to the top, and then start the thing rotating for the night. It was fun to do in the summertime because they didn't travel very far because the nights were short. And Dad didn't have any weights on it because there was no danger of for ice gathering on the line. But in the wintertime, the weights would travel all the way to the bottom, and they'd be burdened down with a whole bunch of steel wheels on them to keep the thing moving down because of the accumulation on the cable. I worked hard in the wintertime bringing it up.
Do you remember your father accepting the position and the conversation your family had to prepare and adjust to this new lifestyle?
Of course, I was only seven, so I probably didn't know what was against up in front of me. But I remember when he came from the post office in 1950, the winter of 54. I'm sorry, 55. I think it was 55. And he said, I hate to open these brown envelopes. And he said, it was great excitement. He said, I got the job as lightkeeper on Southwest St. Paul's. I had no idea where it was, but my mother sure didn't. She was pretty upset by it because she knew we'd be leaving all her friends and going out there all by herself.
And where did you reside at the time when your father accepted the job?
We lived in Neal's Harbor.
When you consider the many shipwrecks that took place off the shores of St. Paul Island, did your family take for granted or realize how important the work was you were doing there?
Well, it was very important to maintain the lighthouse, keep it in working order at all times, and to make sure that it was going to maintain its service through the night. When my pa had to watch every hour so to make sure that it didn't flame out, because the mantles tend to sometimes they would get out of control and cause a fire like it did when we were there. And we had the lighthouse was not in operation for about three or four nights before we get it going again. So that was kind of a severe thing. But it was a very important job for sure, and we realized it at all times.
Can you talk about that fire?
Yes. when Pa looked out the window through the night, the whole thing was a fire. The Fresnel lens assembly, that's the glass that goes, it's like a glass globe made it a curvature lenses, and makes up what's called Fresnel lens assembly. I can't explain it, but it's a variety of curved lenses that go around in a frame that makes sort of an egg shape, and it rotated around the mantle, as I described earlier. And it went ablaze, and what burnt part of the ceiling, it was a steel lighthouse, so the whole thing couldn't burn, but it burnt the paint off of all the walls and the ceiling. But the real problem came about, it wouldn't rotate in the vat of mercury, because the paint chips had fallen down in the seams and to jam the mechanism. So we had to secure the ceiling with many, many 2x4 braces and hoist a 700-pound lens up out of the blocks and tackles, and do that just the two of us, and there are three of us in the family that worked on it, and hoist it up and clean out the mercury out of the base and put it back down again so it could rotate. It was a pretty major operation.
Seems your father remained calm and in control of that. Well, could have been a very drastic situation.
I don't suppose everybody could have figured out how to do it, but I was pretty good at that sort of thing. And what the amazing thing is, he had so many block assemblies, because you know that with the blocks, the Romans discovered that, I think, way back in B.C., how pulleys makes work less difficult. And by putting several blocks and tackles together, my mother, weighing only 100 pounds, hoisted the 700-pound lens up by herself. It took a lot of rope and a lot of pulling to lift that up a foot above the base, but it did it and did the job.
And Billy, you've spoken in the past about some surreal or eerie experiences. Can you share a story or two about what you'd call a ghostly encounter on St. Paul Island?
My mother was told stories about ghosts that were on the island, but we had a Christmas tree up at Christmas Island with bells on it, like decorations like everybody else did. And one morning early, we could hear my sister's cat playing with ornaments on the floor. They were rolling around the floor, and said the cat's having a fun time this morning, but when we went downstairs, there were no bells off the tree, none broken and none loose. But I think the best one I got my mother was a door that leads to the basement of our house. It was, I understand when they built the house, they exhumed or dug up human bones, which is not a surprise, because there's so many people buried in unmarked graves on the island, that they dug up graves when they put the foundation in. And so maybe that's part of the problem, but there was a door to the basement which was locked like every ordinary door. It's caught and catched and was properly secured. But some nights, around 8 o'clock in the evening, we'd hear the door come slowly open and fall against the wall, and somebody would shut it and be doggone, and a few hours later, it'd open again. And Dad was always going to put a latch on the door to hold it secure completely, but Mom wouldn't allow him because she said, I only think the place is haunted now. If the door comes open then, we know for sure it's haunted, but never did that. But that was the only, and bangs against the house, which was unusual too, but and some say it was ghosts, but that's up to your own opinion, I guess, but certainly it was a strange happening.
So did your mom ever want to pack up and leave St. Paul Island after encounters like this?
She complained about it, but she didn't mind it, didn't cause any panic to want her to leave or anything like that. So she handled it very well.
And how about you and your sister, Billy, with the thought that perhaps there was a presence there?
No, we never seemed to mind it. We just took it in stride and didn't hear any ghost stories about anything doing anybody any harm, although I did hear stories before.
What did you and your sister Ina do for fun on St. Paul Island?
We built igloos, we built snow horses, and they had the snow in the wintertime, and I think one of the harrowing experiences that we had was sliding. We took an old sled up behind the house, and down in front of the house, outside the fence, there was a 60-foot vertical drop cliff into the ocean. And one day we were sliding down the hill and running to the fence on the way down, and thought that was quite a bit funny, but later on in the afternoon, our sleigh hit the fence, knocked the poles off, and we went straight through the fence toward the cliff. And we rolled off the sleigh, and the sleigh went over the cliff and into the ocean. Mom and Dad were quite shaken up by that very close call. It just drifted off out to sea. And that's the only game I ever learned how to play, and cards, 45s. And we had rubber horseshoes and a little pin in the floor for your post, and we played horseshoes and read stories and did crossword puzzles and that sort of thing. sorry, jigsaw puzzles. And then listening to the radio. Oh, that radio was a big thing every Sunday evening.
Do you remember which radio station you were listening to?
Not sure. Dad tuned the radio into a station where Aramis Brooks used to come on. Very popular. I Love Lucy.
What about pets? Did you and your family have a family pet there?
We had, Dad had his Newfoundland dog, big black dog, if you're familiar with it, and we had I had sort of a miniature mixed-up collie, and that's the pets we had.
Did anyone in your family require hospitalization during your time on the island, or was there ever a sense of panic when someone would get sick?
Well, it wasn't a panic button, it was a radio telephone that we had a schedule, two schedules a day. And the rule was if they missed you on three schedules, they would send somebody to search see what's going on. But, my mother developed a very sore throat, and Dad had to get on the radio telephone and make a call. And they came by Edward Cornwallis, one of the government supply ships, and took her off the island into Sydney, where she recovered. And 5 weeks later, she was in the hospital for a week, but it took 5 weeks later to get her back.
Have you returned to St. Paul since you and your family packed up and moved to Sherbrooke?
Yes, I've been back several times by boat and visited the old house, and quite a something to go back to the old house and see it. It's all fallen down now, completely on the ground, flat.
And how did you feel when you saw that?
I haven't, to be honest with you, I haven't seen it since it completely collapsed. The first time I went out, everything was pretty much intact, except for the windows were missing, and I went upstairs to my bedroom and kind of hung around and hung out thinking of the olden days. And the next time, the second last time I was out, the whole side was out of the house, and I said to my friends, this is the first time I ever came to a real open house. Since then, it's completely collapsed and flat into the grass now.
What kind of activity goes on there now? I understand there are some ham operators that make an annual trip there.
Yes, I'm a ham operator, and I operated with a group out there a couple of times. But that's about all the activity you see. There's nobody on either end. That's been abandoned since '92. But I have gone back a few times, and I walked around there for sure, walked the old trail.
You had a unique childhood, Billy. When you look back, do you have any regrets, or are you proud to speak about that part of your childhood when you were the son of a lighthouse keeper?
Yes, for sure, but... It was very difficult coming ashore, going to school for the first time in grade 7 at St. Mary's Rural High in Sherbrooke, Nova Scotia, because Dad was transferred to a light station at Port Beckerton on the eastern shore. And, of course, I'd never been around children before, and there were 318 kids, and I thought they must be all here in one spot.
And when you see a lighthouse now, Billy, what do you think about?
I just think about the past when lighthouses were so important to fishermen in years gone by. And now with GPSs and all kinds of navigational aids, it seems like it's too bad that they're obsolete, but that's just the way it's had things go with automation.
And that's our show for today. As always, thanks for listening. For Dialogue, I'm Dave Wilson.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.